Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today was the director of the Chico Veterans Center for 4 years. When David Schaefer retired, he wrote the novel I'm going to be asking him about today. He was born in Chicago and raised on a river in the Midwest, where he developed a love of nature. After earning a bachelor's degree in English education and a master's degree in social work at the University of Illinois, he served 2 years in the United States Army. David Schaefer was posted to Vietnam as a mortar man and a battalion combat correspondent. When he moved to rural Arizona and lived in a traditional hogan on the Navajo Indian Reservation. In 1981, he resettled in Plumas County, California. His novel, Feast of Light, takes place in a war-torn world half a century ago. David Schaefer, welcome.
Thank you.
I'll bet you can welcome us in Vietnamese.
Let's see if I can remember. It's been so long. Chong Mon Yo Kum, something like that.
Well, that looks like what you wrote in your book. I didn't know how to pronounce it, but what you just said looks like it. So you learned some Vietnamese when you were there.
Yeah, I did. Not a lot, but enough to be polite and talk to people, say hi, you know.
Well, you have a point in your book where one of your characters is giving lessons in the Vietnamese language.
Mm-hmm. Hoa.
And pronounce her name again for me.
Hoa.
Hoa.
And it means flower.
I remember. But when I was reading these names in Vietnamese, I didn't know how to pronounce them.
Right,
so
right.
I'll have to ask you that.
Okay.
So Hoa gives our protagonist a lesson in Vietnamese.
Many lessons.
And she was teaching him Vietnamese. And I was fascinated myself because the more I read your book, of course, the more ignorant I felt about this whole culture that you write about. So I appreciated that.
Hmm.
And before I went to China, I learned a few expressions in Chinese, and I knew it was a tonal language, but it only has four tones.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnamese apparently has five or six.
I don't know.
And I also was noticing other things that I think people may know more about China than about Vietnam. For example, when I was in China, rice was three times a day. And that's what they say in your book, that rice sustains life.
Rice sustains life, yes.
And everywhere they go, there are rice paddies.
Right.
Another thing in China, you walk in the door and they're handing you a cup of tea. And I noticed that in your book, they're having tea they never miss a day.
China occupied Vietnam for 1,000 years, you know, and they broke free from it. And then the French came in and occupied them for 100 years. And then we came in and did what we did.
I found that so interesting, too, that that's another thing that China and Vietnam have in common, that that's a culture that China, 5,000-year-old culture?
It's a completely different culture than China. There's still some resentment about China. In fact, there's some resentment about China
from the
Vietnamese. I went back to Vietnam with my wife in 2012 and went to some of the places I'd been stationed and met a lot of people and had a wonderful time. They were very gracious.
My guest is David Schaefer. He was a soldier in Vietnam, and he has written a book, Feast of Light is the title of his book. And David, I'm looking at the cover of your book right now. Oh, my gosh.
I took that picture.
I knew you did.
Yeah.
Because the whole time I was reading your book, I kept thinking, this main character, I'm sure a lot of what happens to him happened to you.
It did.
And I remember page 137. He sees this young girl, and he takes her picture.
That's right.
And I thought, that's the picture in the story, but that's the picture in your story.
Yes. That is true.
You want to describe that photograph on your cover for us that you took?
It's of a little girl. Actually, it wasn't in the market. It was at a camp refugee camp after the Cambodian invasion. And they moved the Vietnamese that were on the Cambodian border to this camp near where my base was. So I was just in there looking around, and I saw this little girl across the crowd, and I had my telephoto lens, and I got her in it, and click, and the rest is history.
Yeah, and there she is staring at us.
She says it all, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. It just touches my heart to look at the picture.
And I made sure it was on the cover of the book. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, no, that's what I want on this.
I can see why.
Yeah.
Well, I throughout your book, I laughed and wanted to cry at different parts of your stories.
Great.
Different scenes.
Yeah.
And one of the first times I laughed was, well, why don't I have you read the opening page or two of your book so we meet the main character.
Okay. And this is the least funny of the whole book.
Well, I laughed after a couple of paragraphs.
Did you?
Yeah.
I made little comments here and there.
Well, I'll tell you why it made me laugh. Okay.
So, chapter one, there's a little poem. The child delights in play. Sinless, he meets the way of war. Juan. The convoy roared through tiny hamlets and villages, ramshackle houses of bamboo frame and palm leaf roof. Flattened soda can walls flashing multiple colors in the morning sun. Blue-gray smoke rose from cooking fires in front of the dwellings, a bitter waft of burning charcoal. Old women crouching before the fires looked up and watched us pass. Men on bicycles quickly got to the shoulders, jumped off, and looked away. But kids, they ran toward the vehicles, shouting words he couldn't understand. The convoy left a choking plume of red dust in its wake. At the front, a jeep with a heavy machine gun on a center post, the gunner standing and holding tight to its grip. Then light and heavy trucks laden with food, ammo, medical supplies, and men. Resupply and spare parts for the Green Machine, the Army's not-so-affectionate nickname. At the rear, an armor-plated personnel carrier moved like a sleek turtle on big wheels, a machine gun attached to its outer shell, the gunner's upper body sticking out. Everything, olive, drab, green. The equipment, the men, and especially me, Nathan thought.
Aha, so this is being told in the first person. And we learn the name of this person is Nathan. Read the next paragraph for us.
Okay. A few days before, Nathan Ben had stepped from a plane, looked up at a full moon, and felt a slap of hot, humid air and alien scents. Nudged forward by the man behind, he went down the ramp, found his duffel bag on the tarmac, and fell into a line of men in dress khaki uniforms. A second line of men in faded and tattered jeans emerged from the darkness like shadows. Idling jet engines, eager to depart, prevented conversation. These men, all smiles and laughter, mouthed what looked like good luck suckers, as they filed by quickly up the steps into the plane.
This is my guest, David Schaefer. He is reading from his novel, and I call it a novel because it is a novel.
It is a novel, yes.
And this is David Schaefer. He wrote Feast of Light. And the reason I had to keep reminding myself it was a novel because it seemed so real. This character seemed so real, and I knew you had to have taken your own experiences and put them in this book. So I just imagine this is how you arrived in Vietnam.
This is indeed, yes.
Now, I told you that the first couple of pages made me laugh when this guy, and repeat his name for us.
Nathan Ben.
Nathan Ben. Nathan Ben. And you're laughing too because I thought to myself, now, that poor guy's got two first names.
And that comes up in here.
And then I'd turn a page and he'd meet somebody and they'd say, hey, you've got two first names. And that's when I started laughing because that was my reaction also.
And that's why I wrote it that way. I wanted people to laugh at that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But of course, and you say everybody has nicknames. Now, did you have a nickname when you were?
I was called Prof. P-R-O-F, because I'd had some college, and I like books. I like to read.
And that's what they called Nathan.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's what they call Nathan. I thought you meant Nathan. See, I can't separate them anymore.
Yes, I had trouble also.
That's right. They call me that,
He
too.
Said, oh, you can call me Nate if you want to,
right,
Nathan.
Right.
But the other's nickname for him was Prof. So
it
that
was
you.
Rarely came up, you know, but that's what they called. And I wasn't, or he, Nathan, wasn't in the mortar platoon that long. And then it just became Nathan or Nate or Nathan Ben.
Yeah. Now, repeat the platoon he was in, Kevin, for us.
Of the mortar platoon?
Uh-huh. Because that's what you did also, too.
Oh, yes. I was in the mortar platoon.
Okay. So your main character is in the mortar. What is that?
A mortar is it's like a tube. Excuse me. It's like...
I mean, if he his occupation is his job.
It was a training that I had and Nathan had in advanced infantry training. And it's a tube that goes into a base plate. And you drop these rounds in it and boof, goes out. You've never seen a mortar round?
Yeah, but I didn't know so that's what a mortarman does. He puts
it's a squad. I was the low on the totem pole, so I dropped them in the tube.
And I can just imagine the noise must have been.
Oh, yeah. You had to bring down and put your hand and had to put it on your head, read around and put it on your ear. It was loud.
Yeah, that's what you did describe, how he protected his ear.
Oh, yeah.
Not with headsets or
earplugs. No. They didn't have any of that. You had artillery, you had guns. I mean, they just... That's why I have tinnitus in my ears.
Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised. So you just had your shoulder.
Well, I'd reach in, I put my right ear into my right shoulder to, as I dropped it on the hoop, I'd tube and I'd jump it like that. Yeah.
Well, we also learned, I thought about how they would name a hill. These hills had names in Vietnamese.
They did.
But we Americans, you tell us, the hill, and then a number.
837. That's how many meters high it was, yeah.
So when he's near our character, Nathan Ben, is near this hill, and it's called Hill 837. Its designation, you just were telling us, that was its elevation in meters.
That's it. All across Vietnam was that way. And, of course, the locals had a name for it, but it was actually Nua Chua Chan. And I called it Nua Chan, Mountain of the Monks, because there was a monastery up there. And that's where they got the name.
Now, you just mentioned the name of this mountain, Mountain of the Monks. And that's another thing I found interesting about the Vietnamese language. They don't have they have only monosyllabic words. There are no multisyllable words. Each word is one syllable.
I think that's right. I don't recall that being right, but I think that's true. Yeah.
I found that fascinating also.
Yeah, not an easy language to learn, not for me or other people.
I can imagine. And I could only imagine how to pronounce some of these names. So
it's hard. I know them from habit. But my wife was my first reader, and she would say something completely different. No, I'd say Juan, Hua.
Uh-huh. H-O-A-N, one of your main characters.
Yeah, National Police.
Juan. Mm-hmm. And then his wife, his sister.
Hua.
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 Hua. H-O-A, without the N.
Yeah, that means flower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My goodness. I also was amused, speaking of the Vietnamese language, military language that I learned from a friend, like, that's 27 clicks from here.
Right.
Do you find that people say, what do you mean, David, clicks?
Well, I had to try to make that as clear as possible. Yeah, clicks, kilometers.
Kilometers, yeah. So if they said, we're 20 clicks from there, then 20 kilometers.
And you had to sort of translate how long was a kilometer in relation to a mile and all that stuff, you know. You did it automatically after a while.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, like my friend didn't think anything about it. He'd say,
right.
Oh, we're 20 clicks from there.
Right.
And... of course, people probably know when somebody says, I'm getting short.
Oh, yes. Doesn't mean they're shrinking. It just means they have fewer days in country. Yeah, there was a whole slang around Vietnam.
That's what I was fascinated by that, learning about military culture and about Vietnamese culture.
Exactly. And the collision between the two.
Yes.
Yes.
goodness.
And that is the world I lived in. And I was like Nathan, very curious. So I tried to learn and get as much as I tried to understand what was going on around me, the war. It was horrible.
In fact, you just used the word curious because that's what they call Ben, a man of compassionate curiosity. They probably called you that.
I don't remember.
A man of compassionate curiosity.
And that described Nathan and described me too.
Yeah, because it was such a different culture than you had grown up in.
Yeah.
Well, tell us what the culture was that you grew up in here in the United States, because the United States have different cultures in different areas. You didn't grow up in California, for example.
No, I grew up in the Midwest. We lived on a river, a really nice river. It was quiet, conservative, just a good place to grow up, you know. And there were no war. What do you call it? What am I trying to say? People weren't protesting it. The Midwesterners are very mild. It wasn't the East Coast. It wasn't the West Coast. So it was a very conservative community and a good community to grow up in. Yeah. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the river.
When you went to University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana.
That's right. That's where I graduated.
So did you also have a sister like your character
does? No, she was made up.
Because you needed somebody to...
To write home to.
Write letters.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and they would kid you when you, you got a letter from somebody named Sarah, huh? You got a girlfriend, huh?
Right. It's even more complicated. We probably shouldn't get into this, but Nathan and Sarah are based on real characters back in the early 1800s.
Well, at least in the story, you have them talking about their ancestors, one is named Nathan and one is named Sarah.
That's where they got their names, yeah. And that's true.
My guest is retired Army veteran David Schaefer, and his book is Feast of Light. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, David Schaefer. He has written a novel, but it has a lot of truth in it. It's based on his experiences in Vietnam. The title of the book is Feast of Light. I was reading your book and kind of laughing to myself, and a friend said, "What are you reading?" And I said, "Well, these soldiers are having what they call a joke and smoke."
Yeah.
Now, was that really a label? Okay, so you sold...
Or smoke and joke, yeah.
Smoke and joke. You get together, smoke and joke.
Yeah.
And so I read him one of the jokes that's in your book.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where the soldier has a girlfriend back home who wants her picture back. And you want to tell us that?
Sure. Oh, tell me that story?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Well, the soldier has a girlfriend back in the United States. She writes him and says, "Hey, I want my photograph back." She's breaking up with him.
Oh,
so,
yeah, yeah.
So how does he respond? Does he send her back her photograph?
I don't think he did he? It was such a different world there. I mean, relationships and your people back home, and people faded. You were focused on there, the war and everything around you. And not that you understood it, but you had to be present. You had to be right there, or you could get killed easily.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so people back in the States, well, they don't know what's going on here. Maybe they're protesting, but they don't know what war is like. They don't know what's happening in Vietnam. And you notice I never mentioned Vietnam.
Oh, I certainly did notice that through the book
or the United States. I was trying to make a book that was about war and peace and what goes on inside of us that brings that war on and what we can do to deal with those feelings and those emotions that perpetuate it.
Yeah, because I looked for that, like, from the very first page, here he is landing, and you do not use the term Vietnam.
Nope, I don't.
And I kept thinking, I turned a page and think, well, he's going to say Vietnam, and you never did.
And I never said the United States either.
Yeah.
I mean, I figured people would recognize it, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Well, to get back to that joke where the girlfriend says, I want my photograph back. So this soldier asked all his friends, hey, you got a picture of a girl?
Oh.
Give me all these pictures. So he sends his girlfriend a whole bunch of pictures that, oh, I don't remember which one you are.
All right. What can you say?
I don't tell it as like you told it in your book. But that was one of the
There was humor things. There, but he had to look for it.
Yeah.
He had to find
it.
Serious.
My guest is David Schaefer, and for 4 years he was the director of the Chico Veterans Center in Chico.
Dealing with combat veterans and PTSD.
Yes.
You
helped combat veterans with PTSD, and you knew whereof you spoke because you had been there and done that.
And I also worked at Eureka Vet Center for 2 years before that. They brought me over here to be the director and stuff. But, it made all the difference in the world doing counseling with war-torn vets if you'd been there.
Oh, yeah.
And then
combine
it with knowledge and experience with counseling. Mm-hmm. And you'd reach people. They would trust you, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was... Honestly, I'll tell you the truth. When I got out of the war, I wanted nothing to do with the war, the military, any of it.
I think that's typical.
And
it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, but a lot of vets come out and, you know, yay, rah, 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 you know, blah, blah, blah. But Vietnam vets were really hurt. And I started to run into them. And I saw how deeply troubled they were. And it just touched me. And that's when I said... Oh, yeah. I think I could work with veterans and help some healing. Yeah, and that's how I got involved there, and I did it for 30 years, different places. You know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My guest is David Schaefer, and we were just mentioning that he was director of the Chico Veterans Center, and he has written a novel. The title is Feast of Light, and as I mentioned, I had to keep reminding myself this is a novel. This is not. But it is based on reality, and when I was reading it, when you read a book, you want to care about the characters. And I did from page one.
That's great.
I cared about this guy named Nathan Benn and the characters that he...
Oh, it touched you. It touched you in your heart.
It really did.
Yeah, I really wanted that. I wanted it to be a good story, but I wanted something that people could feel as well as read.
Yeah. Well, there's a character that I think you... probably knew a character like this, but not in Vietnam, maybe when you worked with Native Americans, and that was Yazzie.
Yazzie.
And I think I can pronounce his name.
His name
Y-A-Z-Z-I-E.
Is Yazzie.
Yeah. And now, was he a character that you knew here in the States, or in, did you?
He was based on a Vietnam veteran Navajo man that I met when I lived on the Navajo.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. I knew some Native people in service, but I didn't know anyone that well. But I knew... Then I worked there for 4 years, and I worked for the tribe, and I got to know Navajo people really well. And this was based on a guy named Joe Charles that I knew really well. He'd been a Marine, and he'd been deeply affected by Vietnam. Good man. So, yes.
Yeah, that's what, when I was reading, and I thought, now, Yazzie is probably somebody that he put into this story because it's taking place in Vietnam, but he probably met him when he was working here in Arizona.
That's true. Yeah.
Did you find similarities between the Vietnamese culture and the Native American culture that we could learn from? Because that's what I found your book. I learned so much reading your book, David.
About the cultures.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was intentional. I wanted to help people, introduce people to this culture. In the dialogue between Yazzie and he was a point man, the first man on the squad, or the company, and he got along with Vietnamese well, because they had some similar experiences as far as dealing with the white man and the white culture as far as conquering and dealing with. Culturally, their beliefs, no, very different, very, very different, yeah.
I'm sure.
But they could feel each other, and feeling was a big part of both cultures.
Well, as an example of a cultural, celebration, I'm going to call it. Did you actually attend a wedding when you were in Vietnam? Because you have your main character go to a wedding.
I did, yeah.
And what impressed you about a wedding in Vietnam?
Well, it was what impressed me about a wedding. How serious they took it. I mean, they had the rituals, and they were surrounded by war and all this stuff, but they still tried to maintain their culture. Yeah, that was actually, they were doing it with a cordon surrounded this village, and they were looking for VC and another thing, and the wedding was going on. And I went to it, and yeah, that's hard to say. I can't even remember the details of it. It was very touching, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, amid all of this, they're still living, they're still trying to maintain their traditions, and they could be dead tomorrow.
Yeah, that's something else we face when we're reading your book, that life and death.
Very close.
Yeah, that's what you have your character saying. Your two main characters, two of your main characters, Juan and Hua, his sister.
Right.
And you take us into her kitchen.
Yeah.
The sister has a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you find people were surprised? Oh, my gosh, that's what, she owned a restaurant and this is what her kitchen is like?
I researched that because I didn't know a Hua that owned them. Like the Lotus Cafe. I didn't.
That was the name of her cafe, the Lotus Cafe.
The Lotus Cafe. No, I didn't know. I studied it. I looked into, I just learned about what it was like. I mean, I definitely saw restaurants and was in them and saw how simple they were, But no, I didn't actually know Hua that ran a restaurant.
Well, she also, back in her living quarters, there's a family altar.
Mm-hmm.
And did you, I'm assuming you probably witnessed something like that.
I did a number of times, yeah. People honoring their, because that's the whole Feast of Light, the title.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
Yeah,
Feast of Light.
There's so much to it. But the Feast of Light and the lady named Q are basic beliefs and it's so important to the world. Still, it's so they take their culture serious. They take all the stuff very serious in a mid-war. And how they did it, I don't know, and survived. Or it helped them to survive, just like the rice paddies, just like everything. It sustained them. It gave them life.
Well, what did they have on this family altar? Do they?
What
did they have on the family altar?
Well, they would have pictures of different family members who were dead, and they would have, they'd burn incense, they put food, water, and they would pray to it. They would bow three times, and they would pray to it, put their hands together and pray to the memory of their families. And Feast of Light, the title, really is about that, but it's, how to put it, it's honoring the dead. That's what it's about. Feast of Light is about honoring the dead. And in this case, it's honoring the dead that they were killed and they don't have their bodies to bury them. So their spirits are wandering, the wandering spirits, the wandering souls.
That comes up often,
that
expression.
Yeah, and that is true, and that's the true stuff about their society. They want to honor the dead even though they don't have their bodies. That comes up with Juan and his parents. But it was really, really calm. So they made different rituals and different days to do that. They call the wandering souls, Feast of Light. Yes.
The title of this novel is Feast of Light. The author is David Schaefer, and he was in the Army, and he was in Vietnam, even though his character in the book, he never uses the term Vietnam. And so on this family altar, they have these different things to honor their ancestors. And they do so more than our culture as far as honoring ancestors.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. It's deeply embedded in their culture to this day.
Yeah, I would think so. I would think so. And then you're saying that they can't bury their ancestors?
Well, no, the ancestors that died, and they didn't have the body to bury.
That's what I mean. Because of the war.
In Vietnam, people disappear. They're blown up by bombs, and they just would honor their spirit. Yeah.
And then, of course, the children suffer.
Oh, yeah.
Orphans. And you tell us in the book, maybe I shouldn't give away the fact that this guy's taking care of this little orphan, and he ends up being able to adopt this kid. Did you actually know that to be the case when somebody you knew?
I knew the person who got the child from war and put him in an orphanage. He did not
bring him back to the United States.
No, he didn't adopt.
Yeah.
No.
Now,
name was Tia.
Yes, in the book.
In the book.
The name is T-I-A.
And really.
And in real life, that was his real name.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I wrote a poem about him that's in this book.
After a break, David Schaefer and I will be back to continue our conversation about his book, Feast of Light. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with the former director of the Chico Veterans Center. His name is David Schaefer, and he's written a novel, Feast of Light. There's a character whose first name is Thich, and I thought, oh, that's the same as Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah.
Who wrote Pieces Every Step.
Right, right.
And
it's kind of based after him. It's Thich Nhat. Yeah, Thich Nhat. His name is Thich.
T-I-C-H for people, T-H-I-C-H. And my understanding now is that's really the title, that's not the name, but a title, like a monk.
It is means monk.
Yeah.
It means monk.
Yeah. Yeah, that it means monk.
That's
and so
right.
I wondered if you did choose that because of a famous Thich Nhat Hanh.
I did. Yeah. He's a favorite of mine.
And he, oh my gosh, he's one of the heroes in this story.
He is.
And I'm going to say what happens to him.
Do you want me to read that part? I'll do it. It's a very moving time.
Okay.
Let's get the page number.
At one of the pages, in page 241, you might read what disturbs this monk.
You don't read what happened to him? I don't mind doing that.
Well, I found it too upsetting.
Well, it is upsetting. I read this to some friends, and they were very moved by it.
Okay.
241?
That's where he's talking. You're quoting
him. Oh, yeah,
him because what bothers him.
I'll read this section.
Okay.
291.
Okay.
Okay. Chapter 19, How to Make Sense of Life, Born, Suffer Pain and Strife, and Death, from Juan. Thich sat at his desk with pen and paper and quickly wrote a letter by candlelight, looking up occasionally to gather his thoughts. He pictured the children laughing and running about the yard in play and smiled.
Because he has an orphanage now, you
Yes, he
say.
Runs the
so
orphanage.
So these children that he's referring to
yes,
are the orphans.
At the orphanage, yes. And Tia was one of them. So, He knew now with certainty what he must do. He finished the letter. He made four copies of the brief note and placed them in neatly addressed envelopes. He slipped one in his pocket and left the others for Brother Kwan to deliver later today. Pushing away from the desk, he stood up. "It is time to leave," he said out loud. Shouldering a large satchel, he left the orphanage at the first hint of dawn. At dawn, Nathan said goodbye to Yur and began the trek down the mountain. He stopped at the monastery and learned the thick had returned to the orphanage. He figured he'd stop by on his way down. He made good time bouncing down the 300 steps, passing the vendors just setting up shop right below the village, right before the village. He called out greetings to them, and they smiled. Somehow he felt lighter. How could he be after such a serious discussion with Yur? He passed under the arch into the village square and then the banyan tree. People beneath the tree's canopy were setting up the day's market. At the gate to Juan's compound, the guard was not at his post. He was down the street looking towards the military intelligent compound. "What are you looking at?" asked Nathan. He didn't answer. Nathan saw a large crowd at its entrance and a plume of black smoke. "Is that a fire? What's happening?" The guard still didn't answer. So Nathan went inside to put his pack away. Better take his camera. Maybe there was a story in the making.
By the way, Nathan has a camera because he is now in this story. He has changed from a mortar man to a correspondent.
A battalion correspondent, yes.
With a camera. Yes. He can take pictures.
That's right. Juan came running up. "What's going on, Juan?" "You are back," he said out of breath. "Wait here. I have to go inside for my sidearm." He rushed back. "Come and prepare yourself." "What do you mean, prepare yourself?" said Nathan, and followed Juan. There was no way to prepare himself. A man sat cross-legged on the ground, hands folded on his lap, back straight, and head erect, engulfed in flames. A crowd of locals and military circled him. The only sound, the crackle of burning flesh, the body blackened and rigid and unrecognizable. A gasoline can and shoulder satchel lay beside him, an envelope on the satchel. "Why doesn't somebody do something?" Nathan yelled at Juan. "It's too late. He is dead." The pain of the flames quickly overwhelmed his body, and his heart stopped. "Who is it?" Juan looked towards Nathan and didn't speak. "Who is it, Juan?" A monk, Nathan, protesting the war. "No," said Nathan. "Who?" Juan again hesitated, then said, "It's thick, Nathan." Nathan dropped his camera. Despite himself, he couldn't look away. Little remained of Thick's face. The skin burned to the skull bone, empty eye sockets. And from his jawline, it looked like he was smiling. "That's not possible," thought Nathan. No. Now he looked away. "Nathan, go to my sister's cafe," Juan yelled. "I must stay for crowd control." Nathan didn't budge. "Nathan, go. That is an order," said Juan. Nathan picked up his camera and stumbled towards the cafe. Juan was outside the cafe looking down the street towards the commotion when Nathan arrived. "What is happening, Nathan?" she said, and saw his eyes stare straight ahead, that he was not okay. "He killed himself. He set himself on fire," stuttered Nathan. Who did this, Nathan?" "Tick, he's dead. He burned himself to death, Juan." "No, that cannot be," she said. "Come inside, Nathan." And she took his arm, led him through the door, put the clothes sign out, and went to her living quarters. "Please sit," she said, and she sat on the veranda's bench, gripping his arm. Nathan slowly sunk onto the bench, still looking straight ahead. Juan took his hand, put it in her lap, and remained quiet. They sat that way as tears began to stream down his face, but he said nothing.
This is my guest, David Schaefer. He's reading from his book, Feast of Light, and he's just read what happened to one of the main characters, a monk who was at a at an orphanage. And we know that this actually happened.
Oh, it happened many times.
And I'm sure you had to study up on it. I mean, I wouldn't expect that you witnessed anything similar to that, but you must have researched.
Yeah, I saw films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to turn to a happier note.
Okay.
And that is a character we haven't talked about yet. And his name, I think I can pronounce, Y-U-R, Yur.
That's his name.
And he is a real mystery.
He is.
But Mr. Curiosity, our main character, Nathan Ben, is very curious. And who is this guy who lives up on a mountain? Who is this guy? And so he gets to know Yur. And I'm going to ask you to read, starting on page 232. Like I was saying, Nathan is very curious, and he's curious about this mystery guy who lives up on this mountain by himself. And but he wants to learn from Yur. So would you start where he goes up and Yur says, "So, my young friend, what brings you here today?"
First, can I ask you about the movement you were doing? It's called Dao Yin, an ancient practice. Let me tell you at a later time, okay? So why are you here? To carry on with our conversation, Yur. Conversation? What do you mean? You know, about the meaning of life and all. That is a waste of your time and mine, I would say. Instead, shall we sit quietly? Well, I don't know. I mean, I could do that anywhere. Really? Could you? Do you? Well, I know. I mean, yes, well, sometimes. Let us do that right now, Nathan, said Yur, and closed his eyes. Nathan closed his eyes. What was this about? He didn't come here to sit and be quiet. Maybe he was wrong to come. Maybe he's just an eccentric old man living alone on the mountain because he can't get along with anybody. And he came all this way for what? An eccentric old man, you think? Yeah, that's true. So what did you hear in the silence? Nathan popped open his eyes. Yur was staring at him. I didn't hear anything. I mean, I was thinking. I don't remember what I heard. Did I hear anything? Pretty noisy in there. So what is it you wish to talk about? I don't know now. Very good. A very good way to begin, said Yur. As you said, how about the meaning of life? Okay. Should I go further?
Well, so this is a conversation that Nathan is having with this guy that lives up on the mountain alone. And this guy is saying, well, just Nathan, just sit there and be quiet.
Right.
And they said, well, that's not why I came up here. And when he first sees him, Yur is doing this. And in my imagination, because I'm not familiar with this term in Vietnamese.
Tai Chi.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. I assume that he was doing Tai Chi. And here's this American who grew up in the Midwest. And what's he doing?
What's he doing?
Yeah. So another thing then, here's Yur living up there by himself, and David wants him to be his guru maybe. And how does Yur react?
To what?
To the way that Nathan is kind of honoring him and asking his advice and asking for his wisdom. And does Yur want to be his guru?
No.
No, he does not.
He does not. And we don't really know who he is. Or where he came from.
Because he won't tell.
No, he won't tell.
Where'd you come from? Because Yur speaks
all kinds of languages.
Yeah. How did he get to know? He's communicating with this foreigner in the foreigner's own language.
Right. Well, he does tell him later on that he was in Nathan's country for a while, so he learned English there. He's been all over the world. He's not any one person. He's a human being, period. And that's how he sees himself.
And Nathan wants to learn from him, and Yur says, "No, just sit and be quiet, and don't expect me to be your guru."
Right, right.
And I was thinking that this is not somebody you knew; that this character is a fictional character based on what you know about, say, Tai Chi, because you practice Tai Chi yourself.
I do. Yeah.
When did you start practicing Tai Chi?
Oh. 30 years ago, 40 years ago.
So so you have your character being curious about this. What's this guy doing?
The character is a combination of a lot of different wise people. That's what it amounts to. I wanted him to meet, because Nathan is young and dumb and, you know, the rest of it.
Naive. I don't know. He doesn't seem to be dumb.
No, he's not dumb. But
because if he's dumb, I'm dumber. Because when I was reading this, oh, my gosh, I didn't know that.
He's curious. He's a very curious and compassionate person. So he wants to learn. And he's drawn to Ur because he gets from Ur someone that has a great knowledge and a great wisdom.
Well, often people like this speak in riddles.
Mm-hmm.
And in your book, and I don't know how listeners can follow this, but the riddle is, what has seven letters, it's impossible to do, and if you eat it, it will kill you. Now, there's like the riddle of the Sphinx. Do you sometimes ask people this riddle?
No, I just put it in here for this to stir people mind. I think it's out of a Zen thing.
It sounds like it.
And you know what the answer to that is?
Nothing,
exactly.
Nothing, the word nothing has seven letters, and it's impossible to do nothing, although I try these days. And if you eat nothing, you won't live.
Right.
It'll kill you to eat nothing. So
that's the riddle.
So I enjoyed that riddle.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
And the answer was nothing. Now,
you can see how many different levels I tried to write this book.
Yes.
Lots and lots.
And another one, you say, we believe what we want to believe.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, gosh, that's true. Oh, well, for example, if I like to drink coffee, I'm going to look at two different studies, and the coffee that says coffee's good for you, that's
right.
The study I'm going
to
believe.
Right.
I believe what I want to believe. And also a person says, we don't listen.
Mm-hmm. We don't.
And that's what you were. You were a listener when these veterans would come to your office.
Yes, yes. I called my approach the art of listening and asking good questions.
Yes. And I used to think that answers were important. I think the questions are what's important, because answers change.
Yeah, and especially in counseling, it's the questions. And whatever comes up from the person is what's important to them. Yeah, it was very intense counseling, but it helped.
Oh, I'm sure. Coming from a person who, you're listening, but you understood what they had been through.
What they're experiencing. Yeah, very true.
Well, I really think people will enjoy your book.
I hope so.
Even though it's upsetting, it's so many times your characters say, this war is wrong.
War is wrong.
Yes, that war is wrong.
Yeah. Look what's going on now.
That was just what I was getting to.
It's wrong.
I was getting to.
You see the suffering and the horror, and it doesn't mean a thing. I mean, it's people's belief systems and wanting to conquer and egos. It's just so wrong, just like this war was.
Well, let me tell listeners again, the title of your book is Feast of Light, and the author is David Schaefer. Thank you, David.
You're very welcome, and I hope people read it. That's why I wrote it.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Collier's Hardware. Before the first flight at Kitty Hawk and before the first car rolled off Henry Ford's assembly line, Collier's Hardware was here, 6 years after the end of the Civil War. For the last 54 of the 154-year history of Collier's, the Lucina family kept it alive. Collier's was the place with creaky wooden floors and worn wooden steps leading to the office where paperwork and inventory was maintained. Change for a parking meter was the price of admission. Parking meters, also gone. If a staff member did not know the answer to your questions, they found someone who did know, and someone always knew. Departments blended together. Bright Le Creuset were a few steps away from the rotary dimmer switches you always wanted to install. Collier's had it all. Even a 5-foot-tall plastic gumball machine. Blue was my favorite gumball flavor. They probably all tasted the same anyway. Shopping always took longer than expected at Collier's. So many things to see, a step back in time, erased. In the office, family members talked business and took inventory. Suddenly, an off-key loud bell would ring. The main register person asked aloud, "We have any non-fogging shower mirrors?" The answer from the office. No, but they can use vinegar with water solution. That'll work. Problem solved. Happy customer. No one was inept at Collier's. Everyone was treated with respect, and they were noticed. First in Broadway, now empty and dark. In the back was an area where things you would think too old or too odd, even for Collier's. Rolls of plastic tubing, chains, wire, and rope, and a full drawer of escutcheon plates. You just can't have too many escutcheon plates. The windows, now dark and vacant. Final items sold for pennies on the dollar. 154 years of history, gone. In the midst of it all, Sil Lucina was still the happy owner he always was. Now people park 75 yards away from the box doors and trek across hot asphalt to the doors magically opening. I like having the responsibility of opening my own doors. Seems people don't care much about business climate now. Lining up single file in the self-checkout line, they may someday recognize the loss of Collier's. Never to hear the old off-key buzzer bell seeking help. Now it will be sprinkler parts, line 3, Mark Malinger.
To the critic who thought I should write more like Hemingway. I like a sentence that sends you roaring up Highway 1, driving a 1964 red Corvette, top down, on a bright summer day, rushing toward New York City, only to have you blow the engine just outside of D.C. Then throws you on a stinking Greyhound bus bound for the coast, with you in the very back seat, where the rumble of the massive diesel engine creates a constant thunder in your ears, shakes your bones, and blots out the sounds of the couple making love under an old Navajo blanket in the seat just in front of you, somewhere between Denver and Cheyenne. David Fillauer.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.